Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Great pleasure to be here. Games are one of my passions, and it's always a pleasure to be among people who have similar thoughts. I'm a researcher at Microsoft Research Cambridge. That's a computer science lab that does fairly fundamental research on all kinds of aspects of computer science. One of them is machine learning, and that's the group I'm working in. And so my talk will be slightly more technical, I think, than some of the previous ones, but I hope I can keep entertaining you. I understand that this is the last talk of the day, so there is some responsibility there. So I'm going to talk about player ranking and matchmaking. And there are a number of interesting aspects about that. I'll tell you how I got into this, because originally I was interested in artificial intelligence. And you know, this is a hot topic these days again, and it certainly is a very interesting topic. But when I was looking at this for games with my friend Ralph Herbrich, we found that yes, having AI in a game did have some advantages. For example, AIs can suffer things that no human player would ever be willing to suffer, in particular grunts running at the Master Chief and being slaughtered. They're also AIs can be very good at specific things. If you give them good headshot abilities, they can play first-person shooters well. It might not be much fun to play against them, though. They certainly don't curse or abuse people, although you could, of course, program them to do so. But when we were looking at this space, and this was a few years ago, what came along was networked multiplayer gaming. And suddenly there was this whole new world out there. You could compete against real intelligence. You know, you could play against players who also tried to use their wits to really make a difference in the game. But not only that, you get all the human stuff. You get creative strategies, and you get language, people talking, and so on. That's all great. And what I always found most important, when you kill someone in a game, they actually care about it. They hate it. Right? And equally, they're very happy when they beat you at something. And so it's just that much more powerful. But whereas this thing is very difficult to solve, the artificial intelligence, in multiplayer, the challenges are solvable. And we develop an algorithm called TrueSkill that estimates how good players are at playing certain games and then use that for matchmaking. And that's what's used in Xbox Live for competitive players matches. And I'm going to tell you how this algorithm works. So matchmaking is important because if you have some kind of match that is not very well balanced in terms of skills, then it's no fun for either player. Some people would contradict that and say that they love to stomp on other people in a game, but you know, there's always a very high price to pay in terms of the satisfaction of the players. And so we need to measure these skills. And there is a tradition in this. The photo here shows Arpad Elo, and he's the guy who invented the Elo system, which is maybe the first statistical system to measure skills from game outcomes and was developed for the game of chess. Quite early in the 1960s. But it doesn't quite address all the problems that we have in online gaming. In particular, we would like to learn from very few matches very efficiently in games, because we talked about the short attention span and the engagement level, the time that you have to engage a player, and it's not long. So if you send them into 5 bad matches, then they're long gone, right? So we need to be very good at quickly estimating the skill. And the second thing is that not all games are just two-player games. There can be team games where we have several players in each team, or there are even games where you have, say, 20 parties playing one another, maybe a racing game with 20 cars and so on. And we'd like to handle those cases as well. And to that end, we developed this algorithm called TrueSkill. Now, here's kind of the formal problem that we're trying to solve. We have match outcomes, and the match outcomes are just rankings of players in the order in which they finish the game. In a racing game, that's pretty clear what that means. In a first-person shooter, maybe that's the number of kills they had, or number of flags that were carried home and so on. The main thing here is that this representation of the game outcome as a ranking is very universal. You can apply that to almost any game. That would be different if you went for a particular score. The number of kills has no interpretation in a racing game, right? So we went to this level of abstraction. And so then the question is, what kind of skill, this number SI here, are we looking for? What kind of property should it have? And the way we define that is that we say the skill of player I is greater than that of player J if the probability that I wins over J is greater than 50%, right? That's the kind of property that we want, and that carries over to teams. It's a stochastic definition. We're not saying that if player A is better than player B, that they always win against them, but there's some randomness in there, right? And that will be crucial here. And so what we would like to get is a global ranking among all players. Let me illustrate these points a little bit. This is from one of my favorite games, Halo. This is the match outcome between two teams here. Here you see the players that were in the red team and that were in the blue team with their associated scores. Here's another set. This is a free-for-all match. And you can see here there were eight players involved. And the outcome now here is a ranking of these eight players. So ELO wouldn't be able to cope with that because it's just for two players, right? And there can even be draws between these because their scores are equal. And so we'd like to be able to take that into account as well. And then what we would like to do is take many of these game outcomes that you can see here and bring them together to get a global ranking of the players. People, of course, are incredibly keen on these kinds of rankings. Global rankings can be problematic sometimes because nobody knows the top guys and how they got there. But you can localize these rankings among friends or geographically and so on, and then people start really caring about them. Okay, so the other thing that we want to do is we want to create fair matches between teams of players. And that's really the main reason why we want to do this, this stuff. Okay, so how do we go about this? I'll use a particular statistical methodology called Bayesian probabilistic modeling. But I will not go into the mathematical details too much. But what you need to understand about this process is we first try to, we assume that we know what the skills of the players are and think about, if we knew it, what would be the game outcome. And then we turn that around and say, okay, we don't actually know what the skills of the players are. We have some beliefs about it, but we don't know. But we do observe a given game outcome. And once we observe it, we propagate that information back to the skills of the players. So that's what the next few slides will show you. So here are the skills. This is the skill of player one, and this is the skill of player two. The S's will always denote skills. And now our little model says the following. We might know these skills, but in a particular game, the players will display a certain performance. And that's not the same as their skill. The performance is a noisy version of their skill. You know, you can be a very good player, but when your daughter cries upstairs, or the phone rings, or you take substances or whatever, this stuff can change, right? And so what we're now saying is that the outcome really depends on the performances, namely the player with a higher performance will win. And so this is our little model for two players competing. And that's actually the same model that ARP at ELO came up with. Now, what do we do when we have teams? Then we have, say, two players in one team, in the red team here. And then we have two players in the blue team here, players three and four. And now we need to somehow determine what will be the performance of the team. And we do something very fishy here. We say the performance of the team is the sum of the skills of its members, and again, with some variation for noise. Now, this can sometimes be a good model, sometimes it's not a good model, but it certainly serves our purpose here. Can you imagine cases where this isn't a good model? Suppose you do racing, and the last one of your team to cross the finishing line determines the position of the team in the race, right? There are such setups. then this is a really poor thing, because then the minimum skilled player will determine the skill of your team. Okay, it's a model, and all models are wrong, and some models are useful, as a famous statistician once said. Okay, so then again, we look, of course, which of the teams had the higher performance, and that will determine the game outcome here. Okay, one more case. We might have more than two teams, in this case, three teams. Team one, just consisting of player one, team two, consisting of players two and three, and team four, consisting of player four. And then, of course, we can compose these skills of the team, again, into a team skill, similarly for these, and then get an outcome. But as you can see, now there's not just two outcomes. For three players, there's more outcomes, three factorial outcomes. That could potentially lead to problems, as you can imagine. For example, if you had 64 people participating, then 64 factorial is a very, very large number. Okay, but fortunately, we observed this bit, right? We let those 64 people players play, and we observe the order in which they come into the target or and finish the game. And so we equip these skills with what we call a Gaussian prior. So we think of them, we don't quite know what these skills are, but we put a distribution over them and say, you know, it's something between 0 and 50 maybe. We don't know what it is. If there were previous games, we will know something more about them. And then we encode the game outcome in this linear fashion, because we know this team, say, won against that one, and that one won against that one, and we can just encode that as constraints. This constraint basically says this must be greater than that, and this constraint says this must be greater than that. And so we've reduced this big combinatorial explosion to this just simple linear observation. Okay, and then we run an algorithm. I will not go into the details. We turn this into what we call a factor graph and then run a message passing algorithm on it. So we'll have some initial beliefs what the skills are. If we have no idea, these beliefs will all be the same. If there have been games observed before, these beliefs will be informative. So some people will believe are stronger, some we believe will be weaker. And then we have these factors here determining what we call the likelihood in the statistical estimation problem, basically incorporating the game outcome into our beliefs. And then we use an algorithm called expectation propagation to run this. And so the way this works is that these little beliefs come in from our database. We know these players, we have beliefs about them in the database. We propagate that down through to the performances. Then we make sure that the performances satisfy the constraints that this one's greater than that and that one's greater than that. And then we send the information back up and update our skills and then send that back to the database. So it's actually not a big computational operation because we pull out the players that are involved, do the updates, write it back. So that's basically how TrueSkill works. And so when I was talking about beliefs, there were really two numbers for each player that characterize the skill. The mean of the skill, the mu here, and the standard deviation, the sigma here. So we're, for ELO, you only ever track one number for how strong a chess player is. But that's limiting because we don't know how precise that number is. And in TrueSkill, you have this extra parameter for each player which tells you how uncertain you are, some kind of error bar. And so now, one purpose of this whole exercise is to create a good leaderboard, to rank everyone after we've seen a lot of game results. And that's pretty difficult with beliefs because there's this uncertainty thing. But we order players by their mean minus three times their standard deviation of the belief. So if someone has a high mean, but we're not very certain about it, that will be penalized. Whereas if someone has a good mean and we're very certain about it, then that mean will stand, so to speak. So ideally, you will have a high mean as a player and will be very certain about it. And then you'll be on top of the leaderboard. And that prevents us from showing wrong people on top of the leaderboard, which is always fatal because it's the most visible part of the leaderboard. And then comes matchmaking. And just a few words about this. We want to get people into games where these skills are close to one another. And of course, for gamers, we would like to get a situation where the outcome is most uncertain. Those are the most interesting games. Imagine you play against someone. Best thing would be that you have a 50-50 chance of winning or losing. Now, for our algorithm, we would like to get the most informative matches. Think of this TrueSkill algorithm as thinking, oh, for whom do I not quite know the skills yet? These two, I don't know who's better. I'll put them together, and then one will win and one will lose, and I'll know more. So it's an information-seeking algorithm. And the beautiful thing is, those two measures are equivalent. If we create the most fun, challenging, balanced games, then we also suck the most information statistically out of these games. And there's a particular equation that we've developed to characterize in the limit what the best matches are. Okay, good. So I'll show you some experimental results on the game that many years ago first started us on this research journey, Halo 2. I don't know, is there anyone who has played this game? Ah, it's good, isn't it? And now on the Xbox One again, this is good stuff. So here you see some kind of episodic evidence how this differs, how TrueSkill differs from ELO. So we had a beta testing, and there were these two players, Char, who shot me into the head several times, and SQL Wildman, and we could see in the old system that as they played more and more games, their skills went up, their estimated skills. You can see that here. And it looked like, under the old system, as if SQL Wildman was better than Char. By the way, it turned out that SQL Wildman, it was the account of a SQL developer in Microsoft, but it later turned out to be his son, his 13-year-old son, I think. And the son would never let the father play again because, you know, it would drag down his skill too much. So you also see that the skill development here is fairly slow. You need, you know, after 200 matches, the system wasn't sure yet how good these players were. And so we applied TrueSkill to this algorithm, and you can see here two things. The convergence is much, much faster than for ELO. So we get to these relatively stationary estimates very, very quickly. And also, it turns out that Char is actually the better player as opposed to SQL Wildman. And later on, we were able to see in the data that, in fact, they had played a few games against one another and Char had come out the winner more often. Of course, we did more quantitative analysis as well. But you could really see this dramatic effect that we could estimate the skills much more quickly using this algorithm. Okay, here are some data from across different games in Xbox Live that use this. And it's instructive because the distribution of skills in these games gives you an idea of what type of game it is. For example, here is golf, and you see 18-hole golf. It's a very broad distribution. That means there are very many levels of skills you can have at 18-hole golf. It's a very skill-based game. Now, here's a racing game, just 3 to 4 laps, relatively small, and you see that the skills are more compactly distributed because it is a game of skill, but also an early crash can upset things and there's more noise in the system. And then finally, here's Uno, and that's pretty much a game of chance, and you see that the skills are very peaked. So there's not much variability in the skills here, because once you know the rules, then you can play it, basically.
Sorry, yeah. What is the spike in
0? Yeah, so that's an initialization artifact. So that's someone who wouldn't have played at all, because we initialized the mean at 25, and then the standard deviation is 25 divided by 3. And we then take mean times minus 3 times standard deviation. So someone who has never played will be displayed at 0. That has to do with the fact that people don't like to be initialized at 25 and then drop. They'd rather be initialized at 0 and then go up to the level where they belong. It's more of a psychological effect. Okay. Here's you can quickly see how the game is in action. Oh no, you can't hear my favorite sound bit. Shame, that needs to be rectified. And you can see here how this works. You have these playlists that people choose, Team Slayer in this case, and then they are displayed with their skill, and here you see the skill distribution in that hopper, and so 33 is actually pretty good. And then it goes into the matchmaking service, is now looking for players to match, and comes up, you know, with a number of players here that are all fairly well matched, and then goes into the game. And people start playing and have fairly balanced matches. Let me give you a little bit of quantitative analysis on that same phenomenon. So in terms of matchmaking, we're interested in having these 50-50 type of matches. And what you will see here is a an illustration of data where this axis is the winning probability. The dots are players or subpopulations of players, and this is their estimated skill level. And so this is now after one game has been played. So half of the people have won every game and half of the people have lost every game, but their skills are still fairly low. Now we'll see this population evolve. And what we would hope to see is that eventually, independent of their skill level, where they end up, they'll all have pretty much roughly 50% winning chance. And so if I play this, oops, this doesn't start the video. Let me do this here, my hand. If I play this video now, you see that as the number of games that people have played goes up, you see in fact that across the different skill levels, most people are in the range of 40 to 60% wins. And that's the result that we wanted to get. Of course, there's a slight S shape. So if you're a really weak player, it's just very hard to find people on the service that even you could beat, right? And if you're a very strong player, it's very hard to find people on the service that could beat you. So that's why you see a slight and deserved bias there. Okay, so I was talking about matchmaking, and just as a piece of practical advice, my colleague Ralf Herbrich and I, a few years back, wrote an article in Game Developer about matchmaking. And one crucial thing that I see going wrong again and again in matchmaking, both skill-based and based on other criteria, is that the waiting time is too long. And the effect is quite easily explained by this approximate equation that describes the waiting time in terms of the time a single match takes, the number of modes that you have in your game for which you match separately, the number of skill buckets that you have in your game, the bucket width being what you still consider acceptable as a good match, the number of players that a game takes, so how many are in the single match concurrently, and the number of players that you have online available. And so if you look at this equation, then you see, of course, if your match takes longer, that takes away these players from your population for a longer time, and your waiting time will be longer. If you have more modes of your game and bucket people up into smaller skills, those buckets will contain fewer players, and again, your waiting time will go up. Similarly, if your game consumes more players in a single gaming session, then that will influence the waiting time. And the only thing that helps you is to have more players. And if you do the math for your game, you will see that you want to keep the number of modes and buckets very small because waiting time sucks. Okay. Now, I'd like to give you, this is relatively old work, almost classical stuff now in the skill estimation literature. I'd like to give you something a little bit newer, which is just an idea yet, but based on some experiments we ran. And that is the idea of matching on personality. Could we somehow estimate or measure the personality of our players and use that information to bring them together into more interesting, engaging, and fun gaming situations. And so the idea here is use social media, online available data, digital traces, you know, all the information that surrounds a single person, like what they do in Facebook, on Twitter, their browsing history or their purchase history or their game interaction history with you, whatever is available. And if you think of this, every individual as being characterized by one point in this very high dimensional space, then we find that these points are not arbitrarily scattered in this space, but they lie on a lower dimensional manifold. So if you know a few of these data points about a person, you can infer a lot of other data points about the person. That's what this lower dimensionality means, high degrees of correlation in this data. And so we use this to estimate people's personalities, because my two research colleagues, David Stilwell and Michal Kaczynski, they collected very interesting data on Facebook where they let people fill in personality tests, also IQ tests, happiness tests, and so on, and at the same time asked them to volunteer their user profiles, which included their friends, their likes, their profile information on Facebook, and so on. And this is a unique research resource, and it's freely available if you register. So if you're interested, there is material that you could work with if you wanted to pursue this idea. And we then have a pipeline where we take each user together with their associated likes. So in some sense, each user is characterized by all the things they like on Facebook. We do a step of dimensionality reduction, and then we do use machine learning to find mappings from these Facebook-like profiles to predictions of people's personality, IQ, degrees of happiness, or whatever other information we're interested in. This has some problematic privacy aspects, and that would be a whole other talk. And so I would caution you to treat this kind of stuff with really carefully. But there is a tremendous potential to also generate values for users in this, I think. So here are some results.
And chalk up another one for big data. A University of Cambridge study analyzed what 58,000 US Facebook users said they liked and compared it to detailed profiles and personality tests that these users later took. And the result was surprisingly accurate estimates of race, age, political views, and even sexuality. Accuracy was lowest, about 60%, when it came to predicting whether a user's parents were still together when they were 21. People whose parents divorced before they were 21 tended to like statements about relationships. Drug users were ID'd with about 65% accuracy, smokers with 73%, and drinkers with 70%. Sexual orientation was also easier to distinguish among men, 88% right there. For women, it was about 75%. Gender, by the way, race, religion, and political views were predicted with high accuracy as well. For instance, white versus black, 95%. Now, here's the key. The more you like something on Facebook, the easier you are to analyze. The correlation of someone's age to the model's prediction rises steadily as the number of likes to analyze increases as well. Ditto for gender. So keep in mind that just because you think you're not revealing a lot of personal details on Facebook, you're still spreading the word to the outside world as well as those online marketers. That is today's Off the Charts.
All right, there's no way I could have said this so quickly as she can. So she is much more practiced in this. She didn't mention the personality traits, which I think could be a central element if you wanted to do good matchmaking online. So now with all the data of people out there, we have these tremendous opportunities to estimate these very personal attributes and then hopefully responsibly use them to make the games better. Okay, just for entertainment, if you bear with me for a little longer, you might be wondering which likes correspond to people with high intelligence and low intelligence, which was one of the things we studied. And if we, these likes correspond to high intelligence, and these likes correspond to low intelligence. Here, high and low. And you can see here, liking The Godfather, I guess that must be the music, movie, Mozart, science, those are very plausible. The Colbert Report was actually quite funny because Colbert then, in the Colbert Report, made fun of the study for 10 minutes and said, you know, if you watch this, you're intelligent, and so on. He also said that he also pulled out this box of curly fries, started eating them, and said, I already begin feeling smarter. So those are plausible. Strangely, this thing is always very difficult for me because I don't know a single thing of those. Is there anyone? Is there anyone who has ever heard of any of this? Well, there is an interesting story. Harley Davidson is kind of an interesting one here, and so one TV crew went to the local Harley Davidson dealer in our area and confronted them with the results. And he said that he was really quite surprised because he had a lot of Cambridge dons on his list of customers and couldn't quite tell why that might be the case. Okay, then here you have another one. Which likes correspond to happiness? These are the happy likes, and those are the unhappy likes. Happy and unhappy. And again, there's some interesting stuff there. People familiar with American politics might recognize names like Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck. And it's kind of interesting that they would be associated with being happy. This is an American sample, by the way. Then you have these Christian associations, which is really nice. I mean, if you believe in God, then apparently you appear to be happy on Facebook. So that's nice. Pride and Prejudice, yeah. I don't know, maybe no, can't comment on that. Swimming is also interesting, athletic activity. And then on the other hand, you have things like science and a lot of, you know, metal bands and stuff like that. Also the iPod, interestingly. So if you like your iPod too much, maybe that's not a very good sign about your happiness. And finally, here's one for extroversion, which I found interesting. We see here things like dancing, socializing, and so on, modeling, cheerleading, associated with outgoing and active, so that makes every sense. And then here's my list of hobbies. you see, you might recognize some of those, given that you are working in the field that you're working in. Okay. So that just as a diversion. But you can see, not only can we get these predictive results, we can also interpret the features that are learned, and they do appear to make sense to some degree. Okay, let me conclude. I've been talking about ranking and matchmaking for competitive games. I explained the TrueSkill algorithm, which, to my knowledge, is the most advanced system if you want to really estimate people's skills based on these ranked-based game outcomes, which basically works across all kinds of games with any number of teams and any number of players. With the matchmaking, you want to make a good trade-off between time and the quality of matchmaking. Don't let people wait for too long. If you're interested, I'd be curious to see if one can pick up this idea of using personality to match things. But in any case, I hope maybe somehow some of these ideas can contribute to more fun in games. Okay, thanks.
Is there a white paper that discusses your mathematical calculations?
There is a... I listed some resources here.
Excellent.
So the about the TrueSkill system, there are some technical papers at the NIPS conference, one discussing the vanilla system and the other one discussing a system that tracks skills through time. And that can, for example, be used in analysis. Let me just see if I have that here. Why is this so slow? We used that in an analysis of chess play. We took a large database of chess games and plotted the skills of chess players over time here from 1850 to the early 2000s, because this system now tracks the skills exactly over time. And so there's some material there, and there's also a paper in Game Developer that discusses the matchmaking aspects, and there's a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences about predicting personality and IQ from digital traces.
So you mentioned around how the true skill tries to match to around 50% win-loss ratio. Obviously, given that you also said that if players play five games in a row and they lose them, that's a bad experience that you want to avoid. But I guess with a 50-50 matchmaking, then you're always going to get that kind of like 2 or 3% that just through look at the statistics end up still losing five in a row. Do you then force them against a much lower skilled player to actually try and get that win in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes every sense to have some business logic that does not quite follow the purely statistical approach, but really picks up on those specific cases. And when we were working with Bungie, they included such provisions in the actual algorithms for the early periods where people were just ramping up. Yeah, cool.
Hi, that was fascinating. Thank you. Do you take into account the velocity of performance as well? Say, for example, you've got a very confident rating on someone. He played a lot of matches. You know how he's very good. But he comes home from the pub late at night after lots of drinks, is not having a good time of it. Is there a sort of temporary, you know, I'll scale down his fight to keep in terms with the velocity of recent performance?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So one thing that I didn't mention, which we have, is that after each game, there is a little bit of of noise added, if you like, or we make the confidence interval a little wider because we allow for the skill to develop over time. So that addresses slow skill development, things like someone getting better because they get more practice, or they're getting worse because they're getting older, things like that. We do not currently take into account these shorter term aspects. We treat them as noise, basically. So someone coming home from the pub, putting in a few games and losing a lot of them would actually experience a little dip in their rating. But some of these players are very sensitive to this, so they would never play if they were under form.
No, I understood. But I can also see, for example, if you have a game installed and you invite friends over to play, and I guess if you're very keen on your ranking, you're not going to let them play.
It's definitely a problem, the identification with the profile, similar to recommendations. My Netflix profile is polluted by some of my relatives' choices, yes. To put it that way. And similar things could happen here. By the way, we also have a pay-to-win mode. People... started services where you could ship off your gamer tag and people would ramp up your true skill and then give it back to you at that higher level. Not officially condoned, of course. It was just an observation we made in the forums.
Any other questions?
Thanks very much for an interesting presentation. Quick question. Have you done an analysis of different game types? So multiple players playing RPG. Do the skill levels match across different game types, or have the analysis only been across a single?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So as statisticians in our role here, we would have liked to do a big joint model where there would be a player, and the player would have some skills, and then through different genres, that would maybe change. You know, they would have these basic motor skills, but then they might be better at one type of game than another, maybe better at shooters than at racing games, and so on. And there would be beautiful hierarchical modeling methodology to do that kind of thing. We also proposed this, but there was another interesting thing coming in which led to this not happening, which was that people apparently felt that the system shouldn't be prejudiced against them when they start. So you can view this as a purely statistical estimation problem, and you can then say, okay, really, you weren't so great in this game, that's the same genre, so we should probably give you a bit of a lower ranking here, a priori at least, unless you prove better. But people felt that in a given game and game mode, everyone should start from the same level. And it would have been considered unfair otherwise. So we have an interesting relation here, because the pure estimation would favor exactly what you're saying. The more information we get, the better. Whereas the fact that these skills are displayed to people also make them some kind of medal. And they're not just estimates anymore. They're things people aspire to, and hence, you know, are opinionated about and discuss them in the forums. And there, people say, don't say, I have an estimated skill level of 45. They say, I'm a 45. That's identification. And that puts limits on what we can do. But yeah, from a statistical point of view, excellent idea.
Any other questions?
No? Thank you very much.
Good, thanks.